Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 6th of October. Few things to say before we get rolling on our program. As many of you did, I learned of the death of Steve Jobs while reading my brand new iPad last night. How sad that was, and how thankful I am to him for all that he did. What a mind he had. What an incredible mind, and what a background. It was just phenomenal. And I was watching the Brewers at the same time, and that wasn't a good evening either, but tomorrow will be better. So we mourn his passing today. He was an incredibly influential person in this world and in the world that we inhabit that we never knew we were going to inhabit not that long ago. We have a really full program today. We're going to be talking about the ever-changing landscape of the presidential election primaries and caucuses, the first hour of our program today. Hour number two, a show I've been looking forward to for a long time. Those of you who have listened to us for many years know that we have interviewed John Katz for years and years and years. It's at least during the last 8 years, because I remember talking to him about what kind of dog I should get for my son, who is allergic to dogs, and my dog is almost 8 years old. So John Katz is going to be with us. His latest book is Going Home, Finding Peace When Pets Die, and we have followed his life on Bedlam Farm for a long time now. He's written about his dogs and cats and roosters and steer and his donkeys, his hospice work, his changing his life as a result of a dog who came into his life, Orson, the amazing dog Orson. John is going to be with us in person. He has just landed, his blog at Bedlam Farm tells us, in Milwaukee. So he's going to be here, along with the director of the Wisconsin Humane Society, along with a dog. Oh, can you believe it? We're all excited. We love to have dogs in our studio. He's doing a special event tonight at the Wisconsin Humane Society, and I would recommend that you call them. The tickets are $5, but it could be a very popular event, and there are dogs that live there, so you may want to call and make your reservation. He'll be talking about Finding Peace When Pets Die, a book that many people need because losing a pet is very, very difficult. And pets are becoming, as he says, much more important in our lives because we don't talk to each other as much as we probably should. So that's coming up, hour number two. This hour of the program, well, who's having what primary when and why is everybody moving up the dates and what does it mean for anybody who may want to enter the race right now? Is it just way too late? Our guest this hour is Professor Josh Putnam, visiting assistant professor of political science at Davidson College. He also was at Wake Forest College before coming to Davidson. He is an avid elections watcher. His focus began, some time ago on American politics and specifically on campaigns and elections. He looks at why some states are able to move their nominating contests and others are not. He will look this hour at the financial impact of moving it too. Some states have chosen not to do that because they just don't have the money to do that. He also runs the elections blog Frontloading HQ, which has garnered national media attention in the lead up to the 2012 presidential election. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Professor Putnam. Here's our number, as always, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and our email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Professor Josh Putnam, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Absolutely, Kathleen. Thanks for having me.
Well, everything's been happening so rapidly the last couple of weeks. I don't know who has what when.
I'm having difficulty keeping track of it myself.
Well, if you are, then we can. Yeah, I would imagine. So why this move to push everything forward?
Well, it's really just a handful of states during this cycle that's pushing this forward, right? So, both the Democratic National Committee and the Republican National Committee, after the 2008 cycle, kind of informally got together and said, look, this whole starting in January thing, it's just not working out for us with the presidential election kind of butting up against not only New Year's, but the holidays with Christmas and all the rest of that. So again, as I said, they informally got together and set something of a skeleton of a calendar to say, look, the first four states, Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, Nevada, they can go in February, but everybody else can pick up on March 6th, the first Tuesday in March, or later. And we entered this calendar year, 2011, with 20 states that had to do something with their state laws or their party rules to change dates, because we had a whole bunch of states that were scheduled for February primaries and caucuses. And out of those 20, 17 have moved back. So we're not hearing about the successes of these rules, but we're hearing about Florida and Michigan and Arizona pushing this earlier and earlier. But it only takes really one state to overturn the apple cart, as I like to say, and we're seeing that play out right now.
And if any other state moves it up, then Iowa and New Hampshire and South Carolina, by golly, who have the tradition here, particularly Iowa and New Hampshire, are not going to let any other state go before them.
That's right. That's right. Again, the feeling there is that both national parties have as the term is, carved out positions for those four states, or those three and Nevada, at the front of this process. And I think what we're hearing out of Florida these days is that, well, maybe that's not fair, and that we don't necessarily want to threaten those four, but we want to be up at the beginning of this process to make sure that we and our voters have input on who the nominee is going to be.
Mm-hmm. You think about this, and it's just around the corner now, isn't it? It's almost impossible with these very early caucuses and primaries to enter the race right now.
And I think we are seeing the best evidence of that this week. Chris Christie's decided not to run, and Sarah Palin yesterday. It's just too late to start from scratch right now, to put the organization in place, to get your foot soldiers in place to make this happen for anybody. You may be able to get the money together if you got, I guess it was the Wall Street folks within the Republican Party who were pining for Chris Christie to get in. But even then, with that money or that financial backing, it was still going to be difficult to put the organization together if he had jumped in. I think that's probably why he decided, I'll wait this out.
Mm-hmm. What's the difference, Professor Putnam, between the way the Republicans go about their nominating process and the way the Democrats do that?
Part of it is how the Republican Party allocates its delegates on a state-by-state basis. So what I mean by that is the Democratic Party, as we saw in 2008, requires that all states allocate their delegates proportionally, so that if Barack Obama gets 60% of the vote in the North Carolina primary, he gets approximately 60% of the delegates. The Republicans traditionally have left this up to the states to decide, and we have this whole bunch of different variations on how they allocate delegates. Some states mirror the Electoral College in that if you win the state vote, whether it's by majority or plurality, you get all the delegates from that state. Others mirror what the Democrats do with a proportional allocation, and about a third of them fall into a hybrid category in between, which some of it's proportional or slightly proportional, and the rest of it is winner take all. Now, in terms of the implications of that, over the years it's meant that because the Republicans have these winner take all rules in place, that theoretically they could determine a candidate maybe slightly before the Democratic Party does, just because that proportional allocation mandate on the Democratic side potentially draws the process out.
Mm-hmm. Does this moving of the primaries, moving everything up a little bit, favor, as I've read in various places, Mitt Romney, because he seems to have the best organization and the most money at this point?
Well, it's not hurting him. Again, having been through this process just 4 years ago, Mitt Romney does have some infrastructure in place. And having a network of fundraisers, having the skeleton of a crew, so to speak, in Iowa and New Hampshire and some of these other early states certainly is to his advantage. Now, does that mean that someone like Rick Perry can't emerge and compete for the nomination? No, but it does make the task more difficult.
Is this creating a lot of tension between and among states? I read that some in Iowa have been annoyed at what Florida is doing, the Iowa Republican National Committeeman and president of the Iowa Faith and Freedom Coalition, said, "It's just so thoughtless of other states to do this, that there are 99 Iowa counties that need to book sites to hold their caucuses, and they can't do so yet because there are only so many halls big enough."
Well, I suppose that's probably true in Nevada, New Hampshire, and South Carolina as well. But, you know, there's a lot of this blame game going on right now of blame Florida. But you can't really blame Florida. At the end of this, it really comes back to the rules and the penalties that are in place from the national party. Florida simply looked at those penalties and said, look, all you're going to do is take away half our delegates. Do we really mind losing half our delegates to the convention? Is that worth it to us to lose that so that we can move up and be fifth in this process and potentially prove decisive in terms of who the nominee is going to be? In their way of, or I guess in their calculus, the determination was, look, we're going to be fifth. We're going to have an influence over this process, that we don't mind the delegate loss. That, you know, some of the thought process is there is that they'll get them back in the end anyway.
Vice President Biden, during an interview in Miami, said that he was happy about this and said the big and important states should have a shot to make a difference in the outcome of the nominating process. We've certainly heard that before. Why Iowa and New Hampshire and South Carolina? They're little states. They shouldn't be that influential.
Well, the benefit of having the smaller states first is that it allows lesser-known candidates to make a play for the nomination, so to speak. So it allows them to get on the ground, to shake the hands, to kiss the babies. There's this retail politics. When we're looking at this from the party's perspective, it's weighing kind of, well, do we want to help the candidates out here, maybe nurture a conversation here that may help us out, or do we want to help the states out? And they're, you know, it's a delicate balance, and obviously the states are finding fault with that, and particularly with the penalties, or at least that they're toothless in this instance.
Mm-hmm. What about the money situation? Are there some states that have to stay where they are, or are moving to another date to coincide with some other election? Because it's fairly expensive to run primaries, is it not?
It is. I mean, with the case in California, for instance, where they had an early February primary in 2008, they've subsequently decided for this cycle to consolidate their presidential primary with those for state and local offices all the way back in June, and that's saving them $100 million. Again, that's California. We've seen a similar sort of circumstance in states like Washington or Kansas, where respectively it's cost them $10 million or I guess $2 to $4 million in Kansas's case. So we've seen a little bit of this. I think this has been overblown to some extent in the media. But it has played something of a role. Some states have eliminated those separate presidential primaries to move back to later dates and save a little money in these tight economic times.
Mm-hmm. We welcome phone calls. We'll take them momentarily for our guest, Professor Josh Putnam. He's a visiting assistant professor of political science at Davidson College. He's a writer for Frontloading HQ blog. It's frontloading.blogspot.com, and he's kept a keen eye on all that's been happening with the shifting primaries. So here's our number. Join us if you would like. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, hour number two of our program, John Katz will be with us. We've interviewed him many times. Today we meet him in person. His latest book is Going Home, Finding Peace When Pets Die. If you're familiar with his books, and I know many of you are big fans, you've read everything that he's ever written, as I have, you'll know that his dog Orson really was a hugely important dog in John's life. He changed his life. He bought Bedlam Farm as a result of this, and he writes a lot about Orson's death. If you live on a farm, animals die. Yeah, we all die. So he's familiar with that process, but it was very hard on him. And it's very hard on many of us when our pets die because of this new kind of bond that we have. So we're going to be talking with him about going home. And it's a special hour for us. We're all dog lovers here and cat lovers. Rhonda is a cat lover and a dog lover. Chrissy and I look at puppies on the internet. Don't tell anybody. And Ann Reed is also going to join us, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Humane Society. And we will have a dog with us in studio. John has just landed at the airport, so he will be here. And we'll talk about the death of our pets and his belief that if you love them, you're meant to have another one. So that's coming up. And he's speaking tonight at 7 o'clock at the Wisconsin Humane Society. You may want to give them a call. The tickets are $5. And Boswell Books is bringing him in. So it will be a good gathering of people. And you may want to go. That's what I'm telling you about it. Here's our number, 800-486-8655, and our email address is talk@wpr.org. One more announcement. President Obama is holding a press conference this morning at 10 o'clock, and you can listen to NPR coverage of the press conference online at wpr.org. What do you think of the nominating process, the states deciding they're going to move their primaries up? Should states like Florida, Michigan, larger states have a say in when and who the nominee is going to be? Are we giving too much weight to smaller states? And why the Republicans are doing this is what we're talking about this hour with Professor Josh Putnam, visiting assistant professor of political science at Davidson College and writer of Front Loading Blog, which you can go to and learn a whole lot about what's going on with early primaries. We spent a lot of years with a Super Tuesday. Is there no longer a Super Tuesday, Professor?
There is, but I'm calling it less Super Tuesday this time around. We've gone from what was a Tuesday full of, I guess we had, 25 to 30 contests in 2008 on the first Tuesday in February, to, I guess we're going to have 12 Republican contests on the first Tuesday in March this time around, which is our Super Tuesday this time. So far fewer states. A lot of that has to do with some of the states that are earlier on the calendar, and the rest of it has to do with some of those rules that I talked about previously that required states to change their February dates to March or later ones.
It does seem to many of us that these elections go on forever. Well, 4 years ago seems like a blink of an eye, but this whole process is so lengthy. Is it too long, do you think?
The fact that it can be long can be a good thing, as we saw in 2008. The fact that the Democratic nomination race went on for as long as it did pay some dividends, particularly for the Democrats. They were able to organize in states that had later primary dates, and in particular, just from an anecdotal perspective, those Indiana and North Carolina primaries in early May, when they were contested, that allowed both the Clinton camp and the Obama camp to organize there. And those were two traditionally red states that went for Obama in 2008, so in the general election. So it can, as I said, pay some dividends. It also allows the voters to really get to know the candidates. Of course, that's contingent upon it lasting that long. I think the issue here is that prior to 2008, nominations were wrapped up very quickly. So if we look back to 2004, we essentially had our candidates in place by mid-February, and that meant that we had a very lengthy general election campaign.
Has it always been, I was in watching the Republican presidential debates that have taken place in the last couple months, have those always been this early? And don't we indeed know our candidates pretty well by the time that these primaries roll around?
On the whole, people generally, the public does not begin paying attention until Iowa or New Hampshire roll around. So, again, you catch the news and see the Iowa or New Hampshire results and say to yourself, oh, that's going on. I mean, that's the case for the average voter, I suppose. In terms of the debates, I don't know that traditionally they started this early, but going back to 2004, I think the Democrats had a debate in South Carolina in May of 2003. So that sort of thing's been going on for a few cycles now, and it's—I don't think we've crept any earlier than May, the year preceding the presidential election year. But again, that's for folks following this to determine, I suppose, whether that's too early or not.
Isn't it amazing to think of people who win? When the caucuses or primaries are starting, just read the newspaper and say, oh, that's going on. We're both living in completely different worlds, aren't we?
I definitely have not had that perspective for a great many years now.
No. What prompted your interest in all of this? Tell me about your keen interest in politics and this process particularly.
Well, this process in particular, when I was in grad school at the University of Georgia, I at some point had to make a decision on what I was going to research on and centered on this. And the blog came out of me wanting to get just some anecdotal evidence of the formation of the primary calendar during the 2008 cycle. So it was just a matter of me kind of collecting other news articles and maybe making some comments here and there. And it's morphed into me being more at the forefront of talking about the dates, potentially where they're going to be and where they end up being.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about why it is that some states, what goes into the decision-making process, have closed primaries and others have open primaries.
Well, here we see the intersection between both the state parties and the state governments. For the most part, that's something, at least with a primary election, that the state government will decide whether it's an open or closed primary. That said, the state party can say, well, look, we don't want this to be an opened or closed primary, that we'd like to invite independents in, or we do not want independents or Democrats or Republicans coming into our primary process. And they can essentially veto that. There have been several Supreme Court cases over the years that have essentially determined that this is party business and that they get to decide who gets to participate in their own primaries or their own nomination fights. So, again, that's based on the First Amendment right of freedom of association. As I said, the parties get to decide that or they have a veto on that. And in most cases, it's fine. The way things are, there's harmony between what the state government has put or codified in their law and what the state party wants in terms of who can participate.
Do you have a preference?
I don't personally. It's from my perspective, it's up to the parties.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to John in St. Germain. Hi, John.
Hi, how are you guys?
All right, how are you, John?
Good. My perspective on this is, especially this year with the Republican candidates for the presidency, is to start with the lowest populated state and finish with the largest, just so you keep in everybody until the very end.
Well, that's an interesting idea.
And there are a number of reform plans that are floating around out there that address that particular issue. Again, it goes back to what I was saying earlier in the program about allowing those smaller states to start this process off, allow the potentially lesser-known candidates to rise up and challenge a front-runner potentially, and that's potentially good for the party.
What do you think, John, of open and closed primaries?
Open and closed in what sense?
In terms of just allowing registered Republicans and open primaries, allowing independents and Democrats to vote.
I think it should be only the party that gets the vote.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay.
Thank you, John.
Thank you much.
Our phone number, in case you would like to join our conversation, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and our email address is talk@wpr.org. We're talking this hour of the program with Professor Josh Putnam, visiting assistant professor of political science at Davidson College, and he writes the Front-Loading HQ blog, that's frontloading.blogspot.com, in which he has a keen eye on all that's going on with the constant shifting these days of primaries, Republican primaries, among the states. We have this really big pledge drive coming up next week, and it's only 5 days from now. We used to have really long, long pledge drives, and you told us that you would like more programming and less pitching. So that's what we are delivering. Our half the time pledge drive will start in just 5 days. So we ask you please to give now at WPR.org. Please, WPR.org. And thank you very, very much. Chris in Sun Prairie is our next caller. Hi, Chris.
Hello. I have a simple question, I think, maybe a statement first. One, this country is pretty self-centered and doesn't ever look to the outside for answers, in my mind, on hardly anything, whether it's health care or politics or business or taxes or what. But I'm wondering, what do other countries do in terms of primaries and elections and parties? Is there some general statement that summarizes European countries, Canada, etc.? And I'll listen off the air.
Thank you, Chris.
That is outside of my area of expertise, but I do have some knowledge of what goes on, particularly in Europe. They have a proportional representation system that allows the parties to essentially select a slate of candidates to be in parliament if their party is to win a majority. So they don't have primaries per se. The party picks who's going to fill the slots in parliament. And again, this is akin to kind of what we're talking about in terms of the party's influence over who can participate. But so the party in those European systems decides who's going to be the candidates, so to speak. And when you go to the poll as a voter in Europe, you're voting for the party, not necessarily for the candidates. And the party then turns around and says, well, okay, we will select so-and-so to be our prime minister in this case.
And we go to Jess from Milwaukee. Hi, Jess.
Hi, how are you today?
Fine, Jess. How are you?
Good. So far, so good.
Good.
I do believe that we should have closed. In other words, Republicans should vote Republicans. This way they're not skewing. Instead of voting for the best person possible, they're going to skew the vote to see our party can beat this person or that person. So I do believe they should be closed in that regard. But my other question or concern is that with the electoral vote, the points that a candidate has to reach, I think we exclude too many smaller states because there's five or six key states based on the number of electoral college votes that they get that they manipulate or they always corner and determine who's going to be the president or whomever. I think what they should do, just to be fair to the smaller states, is based on the percentage of the vote, if a Republican gets 65% of the vote and a Democrat gets 35% of the vote, then they split the electoral votes based on the percentage to each party, and this way that will include more of the smaller states instead of them being excluded. Do you understand my point?
Yes. I mean, I think we're seeing some of this discussion from out of Pennsylvania recently with their discussion of passing legislation to mimic an electoral college allocation in the way that Maine and Nebraska have, so that the electoral votes are allocated according to the votes on the congressional district level. So that if Obama wins the first district in Pennsylvania, he gets one electoral college vote for that. If Republican candidate X gets the second district, they get that electoral vote as well. I have not heard discussed a plan to switch it to directly proportional allocation, as you're talking about.
Right.
Jess, we missed what you were saying, Jess, because everybody was talking at the same time. The first part of what you said, please.
Oh, I'm sorry. Basically, I think this would be a more fair system to split the percentages to include the smaller states. You have states like California, Florida, Ohio, Virginia, and a few others that normally determine the election, and then a state like Wisconsin or Indiana or Idaho or somebody, they don't really count at that point. They're counted and then just ignored because they don't have the electoral numbers.
Right. In that instance, the onus is on the candidates to get as many votes as they can. So in that case, we might see a shift from, you know, looking at battleground states to focusing, or the campaigns focusing on urban areas potentially to turn out the vote. And we would see that particularly on the Democratic side. So again, there's some. I won't go as far as to say dangers in that, but anytime you're talking about changing up the rules with the electoral process, there are always unintended consequences that go along with it.
Mm. Thanks very much for the call. We go next to Sandy in Monroe. Hi, Sandy.
Hi.
Hi.
My comment would be, why can't the primary be held like the regular election and everyone do it on the same day? And I'll take my answer off air.
All right. Thank you.
That is a fair question. Certainly the process is moving more and more towards that, or was when we got to 2008, for instance. So as I mentioned before, we had 25 or 30 contests on February 5th in 2008, and that essentially was a national primary. The problem there is that, again, it disadvantages the small states. It's fair in that everybody gets to go on the same day, but the candidates are going to be focused on turning out the votes in those instances and focusing on the big states, and that's not going to please the folks in the small states.
There are, I know, I believe it's in Arizona where the governor sets the primary date. Do other states do that?
There are a few that do that, and we've seen some changes in that regard in a couple of states this time around. New Hampshire has the flexibility that they have to set a date, wait as long as they can to set a date, because they gave the authority to set the date to the Secretary of State way back in 1976. So when you've got one person that's the decider on this, it's much easier than having to run it through a state legislature and the potential partisan conflicts there.
Mm-hmm.
But Georgia this time around changed up their legislation to give their Secretary of State the power to set the date, similar to New Hampshire. Florida, as we saw recently, also their legislature also gave up their power or authority to set the date and gave it to a nine-person commission. But we're seeing this mostly in states that want to have that flexibility to potentially challenge those early states or at least come right behind them.
We go to Judy in Chippewa Falls next. Hi, Judy.
Hi.
Hi.
I've never been a fan of the Electoral College. My way of thinking is get rid of it altogether. It should be the people that elect the person and not the Electoral College, because there have been times when the wrong person has gotten all the electoral votes and the right person didn't get elected. Is there any way that they could do without the electoral votes?
Doing away with the Electoral College is tough because it's in the Constitution. So that means that there has to be an amendment to the Constitution, which has always been seen as something that would be difficult to get through. That said, there is a plan that's floating around out there right now called the National Popular Vote Plan, which entails essentially that whoever wins the national popular vote, as, say, Al Gore did in 2000, then he would have gotten all of a state's electoral votes, as opposed to being based on the state vote. So essentially, if the system was like that, one candidate would get 538 electoral college votes. And that's a clever way of circumventing the need for an amendment to the Constitution, but there are questions behind that plan in terms of it being a compact between states, something that is also prohibited by the Constitution.
Okay, well, I just think that there's too many people getting elected the wrong way, and it should be the popular vote of the people that want the person and not some electoral voting, I guess.
Right, and again, I agree with you that that opportunity exists or that potential exists for the Electoral College to be contrary to the popular vote. But we just, you know, it's been fairly rare over the course of the American system since the Constitution was put in place.
It's something we've been debating in debate class since I was in high school, which
was a long
time ago. So we keep talking about it. Brian and Stephen's point, my question is, what is the history of primary elections in the U.S.? How is it that Iowa and New Hampshire ended up having the earliest primaries, giving them an unrealistic influence on the campaigns, given their small populations and idiosyncratic politics, if I can use that word in this context? Of course you can, Brian. What do you say?
Well, New Hampshire's had their first in the nation primary since 1912.
Wow.
They just it was scheduled for the I guess the second or third Tuesday in March, and the law on the books in New Hampshire still calls for that date. But it also provides their Secretary of State the ability to set the New Hampshire primary at least 7 days before any subsequent or similar contest, whether it be a primary or caucus. So, again, up until the point that we get to 1972, again, that 60-year period, primaries weren't binding on the nominations, that they were merely beauty contests for candidates to go in and demonstrate that, hey, I've got some support in this state or that state, and take that information, so to speak, or data to the convention and say, look, I can do well in all these states. Now that we're here at the convention, we can get back in these smoke-filled rooms and you can decide whether or not I'd be a good choice for you or not. That changed once we get through the 1968 elections and usher in a fundamental series of reforms on the Democratic side first. These McGovern-Frazier reforms made the ultimately primaries binding on the decision. So they determined the delegates that then went to the convention, and those delegates were bound by the vote in the states at that point. So New Hampshire has, since that those reforms have been put in place, has gradually moved their date earlier and earlier. And in terms of Iowa, I'm not as clear on how they got to where they were. I just know that in 1972 they scheduled their caucuses prior to New Hampshire. That was seen as okay in New Hampshire's eyes in those days. And that has been kind of grandfathered into New Hampshire state law on that they'll allow Iowa to go before them, but that's it.
Mm-hmm. We had a chance to take our show to Iowa back in the 2008 presidential campaign to Dubuque and went to those caucuses. They are so phenomenally interesting.
Oh, yeah.
Aren't they?
They really are. I haven't been, but C-SPAN is lovely in that they give us a glimpse into a few of them every election cycle. And they really are fascinating contests.
Yeah. We're going to welcome more phone calls in a moment. We're looking at the ever-changing landscape of the presidential election primaries and learning some history about how we got to where we are. This hour of the program, Professor Josh Putnam, visiting assistant professor of political science at Davidson College, is our guest. He also writes this blog. Those of you who are keenly interested in this, he is the expert in this field. So go to frontloading.blogspot.com as he keeps us informed of all that's happening. President Obama is holding a press conference this morning at 10 o'clock, and you can listen to NPR coverage of the press conference online at WPR.org. We, the second hour of our program, will have John Katz with us in our downtown Milwaukee studios. Also, the executive director of the Wisconsin Humane Society will be joining us. Also, a dog will be joining us. John has written, I think, an important book for people going home, Finding Peace When Pets Die. And he will be speaking to people tonight and to us about this. It's something that's very hard to go through. He writes poetically, as you know, from his many writings from Bedlam Farm. So he will be with us along with the director of the Wisconsin Humane Society. That event is at 7 o'clock tonight. It will be packed, I think, because this is something that touches all of us who love dogs and cats. So you may want to attend. All right, more phone calls in a moment. Here's the number, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Here's an email from Bernie in Elkhorn. The primaries should be under complete control of the parties, he writes. I would have no objection if the party had no public primary at all. If we don't like what a party offers, we're free to vote for another one or start a new party. Ideally, if one votes in a given party's primary, they should have this recorded and be issued ballots to require voting for that party's candidates should they vote in the related general election.
Yeah, I mean, this is a tough thing, I suppose. You know, we've mentioned this before, at least in terms of, I guess I have issue with the notion of making this or not making this public. But basically, this all comes back to this quote unquote chaos that we're seeing right now. Boils down to the lack of penalties on the part of both national parties, that they have penalties in place, as we talked about before. You know, Florida, for instance, has, you know, weighed the balance there and said, look, the penalties are not large enough to prevent us from moving up or to sway our thinking in terms of wanting to be fifth in this process. So ideally, a good first step, as we saw after the 2008 cycle, was to get together the Republican National Committee and the Democratic National Committee and informally set up the calendar idea that we've talked about. Obviously, that's failed this time around. It's because the parties didn't simultaneously set together, in this case, a set of penalties and stick to them. Part of the problem has been that the parties just have not stuck to those penalties over the years. And that's, you know, again, as I said before, they ultimately give the delegates back to any state that violates these rules. But that's the next frontier for this. We're not likely to see any fundamental change to this process just based on the fact that the parties are fine with it. They're wary of unintended consequences, and at the end of the day, the process still outputs candidates who can do well in the general election.
Mm-hmm. Professor Putnam, what influence do the candidates themselves and the people who are working for them have on this primary process? Are they lobbying states like Florida, Michigan, et cetera?
There is some anecdotal evidence that that takes place. I mean, it has happened over the years. If we look back to 1992, Bill Clinton, who was then, I guess he was ex-governor by that point of Arkansas, had discussed with then-governor of Georgia, Zell Miller, the idea of Georgia moving up its primary for the 1992 cycle so that Clinton could have a southern state immediately after New Hampshire that could give him some or a delegate boost should he be in trouble at that point. Again, they knew each other from the Southern Governors Association and worked that out. This time around, we've seen some talk of the Romney folks, or at least Romney supporters in Utah, trying to get the state there to move up their primary. They're the last contest on June 26th right now, and the idea has been floated around that the Romney folks are pushing for an earlier date, but doesn't look like it's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Does it happen? Yes. Is it widespread? No, not that we know, at least.
Mike from Madison, hi.
Oh, hi. Yeah, I was listening to the thing with the electoral, and of course it's just debated back and forth. I don't think a lot of states would have much representation without the Electoral College. But a basic point of history, Kennedy and Nixon, it was said that Kennedy lost in the popular vote, but he won electoral. I guess if you change the system, Nixon would have won, huh? It would be a different history.
I thought he won the popular vote, didn't he?
That's not one of those instances where the Electoral College and popular vote were in conflict. It was very close, but that's not one of the instances. Again, 2000 was one, and we have to go back to 1876, I think, for another instance of that.
Yeah. Thanks, Mike. Bob in Sparta, hi.
Good morning. And again, with the Electoral College, we're a country that believes in checks and balances, and I feel that if the states in what is referred to as the flyover country were to go to this proportionalized awarding of electoral votes, non-populous states such as the Dakotas would lose out a great deal because their electoral college is based on the number of senators and the number of representatives. If we're interested in having the country run by the East Coast and the West Coast, where the greater population is, and Chicago, then we would expect that type of mentality to tell our farmers how to raise whatever they're raising. I think that we would be foolish to do that, in that Wisconsin has 11 electoral votes, and we probably wouldn't see a candidate, and we wouldn't get to ask him questions that would flesh out his positions on items that are important to us, and hope this sparks more discussion.
Well, yeah, and Wisconsin has traditionally been, or at least over the last few cycles, maybe with the exception of 2008, been a pretty close state. So removing the Electoral College potentially removes Wisconsin from that equation, and states that are smaller than Wisconsin as well. Due to the setup of the Electoral College, it does give voice to some of these little states that they're part of the calculus for a candidate trying to get to 270. Otherwise, we wouldn't see candidates going to Nevada or Colorado or even Iowa and New Hampshire, who have happened to have been close the last few cycles.
Thank you, Bob. Thanks for the call. I know this isn't your area of expertise, but I can't have you on the air without asking you about changes that are taking place in states when it comes to voting, voter ID, not being able to have as much time to vote, some shortening the amount of time. There are a lot of changes on the way for 2012. Is that going to be confusing to voters, do you think, Professor?
It potentially could be. I mean, the jury's out on this. Number one, a lot of these changes have been made because there's this perception that there's widespread fraud,
right,
when there's, in actuality, not all that much fraud involved in the voting process. Sure, there are some instances of it, but it's not a widespread process. And the second part of this is that, yes, theoretically, it negatively affects potentially low-income voters, minority voters, folks who traditionally vote with the Democratic Party. I think both sides are probably overplaying this to some extent, that it's probably not going to be as bad as what some Democrats are saying, and it probably won't be as beneficial, perhaps, as some Republicans are hoping.
Thanks very much, Bob, for the call. Let's go to Paul in Hillsboro. Hi, Paul.
Hi. I know you want to talk about primaries, and I liked that earlier caller's idea of the small states earlier and the big states later. But I did want to say something about Electoral College. Since they're allocated to states based on congressional representation, why aren't they just counted according to congressional representation? What I mean is, say in Wisconsin, 51% of the state votes for candidate A. Candidate A would get two electoral college votes based on the two senators that we have. And then all the rest of the electoral college votes would come according to congressional district. Each district would then elect one elector to the electoral college.
Right, and that's what Maine and Nebraska have had on the books for several years now, and what's being discussed in Pennsylvania. Again, that decision is one that's up to the states. They can decide that they want to give all their electoral votes to only redheaded candidates if they wanted to. It's up to their it's at their discretion that they can make those changes. I don't think they'll do that. It seems like the only two options on the table are the one you mentioned and the one we've currently got. As to whether or not that's a good idea or a bad idea. Again, if we look at the results there, Obama still would have won in 2008, but the electoral vote total would have been far less. I think he would have won looking at the blog here, I've got something on this, with 301 electoral votes to 237 for McCain. So far less than that 65 electoral vote total that Obama had, based on that. But again, that's a decision that sits up to the states. That's why it's being discussed in Pennsylvania right now.
Thank you, Paul. Thanks very much for your call. Professor, thank you so much for being with us. You're updating information constantly, I'm sure, on your blog.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Oh yeah. And that's frontloading.blogspot.com.
Thanks, Kathleen. I appreciate it. It was a pleasure to be here.
Thank you, Josh, so much. Really appreciated all your expertise on this topic. Professor Josh Putnam, visiting assistant professor of political science at Davidson College. And again, his blog spot, if you're following this closely, and if you're listening to us, I assume you are, frontloading.blogspot.com. We thank him so much for being with us. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to Chrissy Pease for on-air production. More programming and less pitching. It's what you told us you wanted, and that is what we're delivering. I hope you're happy about this. We're happy about this. Our pledge drive starts in 5 days, but we're cutting it way short this fall because that's what you want, and quite frankly, it's better for us too because we like our extraordinary shows. So please don't wait. You can give now at WPR.org, WPR.org. I invite you to go to our Facebook page now if you would like. It's the Kathleen Dunn Show, and there is information there about the event tonight at the Wisconsin Humane Society that features John Katz. John is going to be with us momentarily. His latest book is Going Home, Finding Peace When Pets Die. We're also going to have in our studios the executive director of the Wisconsin Humane Society, and Chrissy just showed me through the window here the four-month-old beagle puppy who's going to be with us as well. She took his picture, and he's on Facebook, too, so write a comment about him. Did I say it's the Kathleen Dunn Show is the Facebook page. We'll be back.